Hey, welcome everybody to our 3 Ideas in 30 Minutes. Hope you enjoy your chillant on this freezing cold Florida evening. Reminds you of what you left in New York by coming down here. And I just want to start off by really expressing my gratitude that everyone comes. Obviously, it's nice to give a shiur, but it's not nice to give a shiur to an empty room. So I just want to know I appreciate everyone coming each and every Thursday night. It really doesn't just enhance the learning, but it makes it a chabur. It really makes it a learning group. And a bunch of us stay afterwards sometimes and share feedback on the Divrei Torah. So I do cherish everyone who comes. I also want to say that it was very gratifying. I was in New York the last two Shabbases for an Ufruf and then for my in-law's 50th wedding anniversary. And in both cases, everywhere I went, people were commenting on which was their favorite idea and the ideas. And it's nice that we have really built a community of people who are talking about these Divrei Torah. And I appreciate everyone, and please God, we'll continue to be able to spread these Divrei Torah for many years to come. Okay, I always share which one I think is going to be my favorite, but I'm going to be honest. I was thinking during Ma'ariv, which I guess I shouldn't admit publicly, but I was thinking during Ma'ariv, and I like them all. So I guess I'm going to withhold my judgment until the end, and then as it comes out, I'll tell you which one I like the best as it was coming out, although you guys can usually see which one I'm most passionate about. Okay, the first idea I love. The first idea comes from the beginning of the Parsha, or the middle of the parsha, I should say, when Yaakov calls around the 12 sons. Yaakov, of course, is on his deathbed, and he gathers around the Shvatim, and the Pasuk tells us, Vayikra Yaakov el bana, Vayomer heasvu, gather around, Ve'agidu lachem es asher yikra eschem ve'acharis hayamim. Yaakov Avinu says, gather around, because I'm going to give you the big secret. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. Now, there's a lot that could be said about this Pasuk. Yaakov Kamenetsky has a somewhat famous idea about this pasuk, about why did Yaakov Avinu need to gather around all of the sons if he's then going to give them each individual brachos? Wouldn't it have made more sense to have a line outside the room, and then one by one he would call them in? Reuven, now you have Yechidus, now you have, you know, time alone with Abba, and then Shimon, and then Levi. Why did he call them together? So Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky very beautifully says that the idea was that as he was going to give them individual brachos, he didn't want there to be a sense of competition or jealousy or to one person think that they had a monopoly, but he gathers them all together so they could all hear that each one is going to have a different path. Reuven, you're going to be different than Shimon, and Shimon, you're going to be different than Levi. But by all of them hearing that, they understand and appreciate that the same way in an army, so you need the military, you need the navy, you need the Marines, right? Different parts of the army serve different functions. So too in Klal Yisrael, right? There's the Reuven unit of the army. There's the Shimon army of the unit of the army. There's the Levi unit of the army. Lest you think that one is better than the other, they're all around the table with Yaakov. That's Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky's idea. But I want to share with you, I forgot when I saw it. I saw it about 10 years ago, which is probably why I forgot where I saw it. But I saw the following observation. If you look in the translation, Yaakov says, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen, ba'acharis hayamim. And Rashi tells us, what does that mean? Bikesh legalos esakets. Yaakov wanted to reveal the end of days, or when exile was going to end. V'nistalkam imenu shechina. And at that point, the shechina departed from Yaakov, and he started saying other things instead. This, by the way, is any public speaker's, this is any public speaker's worst nightmare. Happened to me, actually, the first Dvar Torah I ever gave in Yeshivat Shalavim in my year in Israel. So they asked me to speak. It was like a Shabbaton. They asked me to speak on a Friday night. So I prepared. It was like an idea from the Nesiva Shalom. I prepared for days in advance, and I wrote it down on a piece of paper. There's only one problem. They forgot to tell me that at the Tish, the lights were out, and I couldn't look at my piece of paper. And so I literally was about to start speaking, and my mind went completely blank. It was the most embarrassing, humiliating experience of my entire speaking career. It's only gone uphill from then, thank God, right? But this is exactly what happens to Yaakov Avinu. He wants to legalos esakets, and Hashem removes it from him. But if you look at the pasuk, you'll notice, and I highlighted this, I bolded it for you. Rashi uses a different word than the pasuk. The pasuk says, Esa shiri kroschem bi'acharis hayamim, which we translate as the days to come or the end of days. Rashi says, Bikosh legalos esakets. He wanted to tell what's going to happen at the end of days. Haketz and acharis hayamim do not mean the same thing. Acharis hayamim, if we were trying to say the end of days, what would we say? We would say ketz hayamim. Why does this pasuk specifically say acharis hayamim? So I saw a number of years ago the following beautiful suggestion. that Yaakov was not talking about the end of days in terms of like the eschatological age, that he was going to say when Mashiach was going to come and when Tchiyas HaMeisim would be. Rather, Acharis HaYamim, Yaakov Avinu was telling his children never to believe in endings. That in Judaism and in the Jewish history, there's always an Acharis HaYamim. There's always an Acharei. There's always something that comes next. In other words, he's telling his sons, you might think that we're putting a bow on Jewish history. We've had Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. We've had the Avos. And as Yaakov is about to depart from the scene, that's it. There's an end to Jewish history right now. Comes along Yaakov Avinu and says that I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Be Acharis HaYamim. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen next. Because what Yaakov Avinu is really teaching his children is that there's no such thing as an ending in Judaism. But there's always something that comes next. There's always a what's next. I said this over the other day. I spoke at a networking event. I said it reminds me of one of my favorite scenes of West Wing, for those who remember. There are very few TV shows that you could quote that were like not just kosher, but that really there was like chachma and musar to them. West Wing is one of them. But one of the famous scenes was when President Bartlett would always say to his aides, he would always say the phrase, what's next? And if you remember, for those who watch the show, one of the premise of the shows was a very fast-moving show. There was always like dynamism to it. They were always going on to something else. And that was characterized and captured by this phrase, what's next? I think President Bartlett ripped it off of Yaakov Avinu. Because Yaakov Avinu was the first one to say, what's next? That we don't believe in endings. We don't believe that we ever sit on our laurels and accept the status quo or accept our past accomplishments. But there's always a sense in Judaism of what's next. I saw that idea a number of years ago. I thought it was a beautiful idea. And I think it's a very motivational idea for us to remember that we should never let our past successes satisfy us. But we should always be, like Yaakov Avinu says, be acharis hayamim. We should always be saying to ourselves, there's always something that can come next. And then I saw this idea from Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs, Zichrona Livracha, where he writes the following. And he does not quote this idea, but he literally could have connected the two, and I'm going to connect them for him. He says, if you look at Judaism, and specifically the Torah is the only book in world history that never has an ending, by design, or frustratingly by design. He says, if you think about it, Sefer Bereishis, where should Sefer Bereishis end if you or I were writing it as a novel with a beginning, middle, and end? Sefer Bereishis should end back in Eretz Yisrael, or in Canaan. Where do we end? We end in exile. It's an incomplete existence. And then he describes Sefer Shmos. Sefer Shmos, we start in exile, and we leave Mitzrayim. Where do you think Sefer Shmos is supposed to end? In our entering into land of Israel. We know that doesn't happen. And then we come to Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim, all of which were wandering aimlessly in the desert. And you come to the end of Devarim, and where do you expect the Torah to end? With us marching triumphantly into Eretz Yisrael. And yet, where does Sefer Devarim, Chamisha Chumshei Torah, the book of Moshe, end? We're not in the Eretz Yisrael. Where are we? We're on the cusp. We're on the precipice to go into the land of Israel. And then he says, if you look even at the end of Divrei Yamim, he says, Tanakh as a whole ends in Divrei Yamim with the Jews in exile again, this time in Babylonia, and Cyrus giving them permission to return. We are almost back where we began, in the same region from which Avram and his family first set out. I know of no other stories that have the same form, namely a beginning, but no end. The same is true, again, I skipped a little bit, of Jewish belief. Judaism is the only civilization whose golden age is in the future. And that's the key line here. Judaism is the only religious civilization whose golden age is always going to be in the future. And that's, I think, what Yaakov is capturing by telling us, "Bi acharis hayamim," that there's always another part to the story, that the chapters might end, but the story continues on. At the end of Sefer Bereishis, the story goes on. At the end of Sefer Shmos, the story goes on. At the end of Devarim, the story goes on. At the end of Divrei Yamim, the story goes on. And it goes on and on and on. Why is it this, Rabbi Sachs? He says, because at the heart of Judaism is a belief so fundamental to Western civilization that we take it for granted, yet it is anything but self-evident. It has been challenged many times, rarely more than today. It is the belief in human freedom. We are what we choose to be. Society is what we choose to make it. The future is open. There is nothing inevitable in the affairs of mankind. So Rabbi Sachs takes in a little bit different view, but he argues that this notion that there's no such thing as an ending in Judaism is a reminder to us that we can create that next chapter. We get to write that next chapter. That there's always that acharis hayamim, that we have a past, and we have a present. But what the future looks like, what that acharis hayamim looks like, so that's up to us to decide. That's for us to write that next chapter in the book. And I think that's why, if you look at Rashi, where it says, Bikesh legalos as a kates, v'nistalka mimenu ashchina. Why does the Shechina depart at that moment? What would have been so bad about Yaakov describing Mashiach in Tchias HaMesim? Because what Hashem is really telling him, Yaakov wanted to tell about the end. Yaakov wanted to finish the story. He wanted to tell us how the story ended. And Hashem says, no, 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 you don't get to do that. Because it's up to each and every generation to write that next chapter. You don't get to tell them how the book's going to end. How the book ends will depend on each generation, in the next generation, in the next generation. So you and I have been given a book. We've been given the Torah, we've been given Tanakh, we've been given Gemara, Rishonim, Achronim. We've been given 2,000 years of Jewish history. But what that next chapter looks like, what that Acharis Hayamim, that's not a fait accompli. That's for us to write that next chapter. And I love that idea. I find it so empowering. I find it so motivational. And I think it really challenges us to take what we've been given, to take the totality of Jewish history that we've been given, and to recognize that what the future looks like is completely up to us and completely up to what we make it. And I think that has been the secret sauce of Jewish history. I think that's what's allowed us to persevere and sustain ourselves through thousands of years of exile and hardship, is always recognizing that whatever situation we're in now does not define us for eternity, but there's always going to be an acharis hayamim, that there's a future, that there's a future narrative that we can write. I think it's why so many Jews have been so successful throughout history. Despite our numerical odds, we've outsized ourselves in terms of contributions to the world, because we understand that the world is always only going to change, and the world is only going to be better if we make it better. And so even if we're in 1940 Europe, or we're 1900 in the Pale of the Settlement, wherever we have been in Jewish history, we've always recognized that there is that acharis hayamim, that there's a new chapter to be written, and someone's got to step forward and write it. And we've always been the ones to do that. So I think that's coupling this idea of acharis hayamim with the idea of Rabbi Sacks is an incredibly inspiring and motivational idea about our role in writing the future chapters of Jewish history. That is idea number one. I hope you liked it as much as I did. Idea number two comes from Reb Biederman. I think it's the first time in 5 years of doing this that we've quoted Reb Biederman inside. You know, everyone quoted Reb Biederman at first, and then they translate into English, and that ruined it for rabbis. But this is a beautiful, beautiful idea from Reb Biederman, and I think you're going to like this one. This is very psychological. He writes the following, that when Yaakov goes to bless Ephraim and Menashe, the Pasuk says the following, Vayivarchem bayom hahu leimor, that he blessed them on that day, saying, ask Reb Biederman, he's quoting the Beis Aharon and others, why'd you have to write the words bayom hahu? Don't we know it's on that day? Do we care if it's on that day? Right? I don't know what day Sarah spoke to Yaakov about X, Y, and Z. Like, in other words, the Torah doesn't need to tell us chronological events, except for the fact that it's important for it to tell us. So why is it significant to say, Bayom Ahu? The Pasuk could have just written, Vayivarchem Leimor, that Yaakov gives a bracha to Ephraim and Asher, and he said to them, why does it have to be Bayom Ahu? Says Reb Biederman, quoting the Beis Aharon, something beautiful. He says that what he really gave them a bracha to is that, and this is, oh, this is ironically the exact opposite of the first idea. I just realized. Okay, I'll say it complements the first idea. He says, Berachem, shetadir yamdu lifneim rak osoayom. This is so funny, okay? He says, what I want you to focus is on today. Shehim om timbo. Today is your focus. V'yanu li yitzram, and you should answer to your yitzahara. Ein lanu kol shaychus emaisei shel emes. I'm not going to forget the past, or I'm going to ignore the past. Veloim shamacharas, and I'm not even going to stress about the future. El lanu ella hayom hahu. All I have is today. Oso hayom bo anu nimsim. Today is what I have to focus on. Bo anu maschilim lavod es HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's today that I have to focus on my service of Hashem. Why do I love this idea? I love this idea because I think psychologically, and certainly in my experience in counseling and my experience with dealing with various challenges that people face, they face two challenges. One is their past. I've tried this. I've always failed. I've never succeeded. I'm not alert, right? They tell them a narrative based on their past experience. Because I wasn't something in the past, therefore, they say, I'm not going to be something in the present or in the future. And so one of the things you try to help someone understand is that you can't allow your past to define you. The second thing that holds people back is an anxiety about the future. So if I were to tell someone now, I think it's a good idea for you to learn Shnai Mikra, I think you should try learning Daf Yomi, I think you... So internally, subconsciously, someone says to themselves, I've been down this road in the past. I know what's going to happen. I've tried it. I've gotten 3 days in. And then I'm not going to get the fourth day, so why even bother trying? And it's not just the past that holds them back, but it's the fear that they're going to fail in the future that prevents them from even trying. In fact, my son has a sign in his room that his Bubby gave to him that says, it's quoted to Babe Ruth, but I'm guessing Babe Ruth never said it, but it says, don't let the fear of striking out prevent you from playing the game. And that's exactly what people fear. They say, because I'm not going to finish, so I'm not even going to try. And so there are two things that hold people back. There's the failures of the past, or the baggage of the past, or the mistakes of the past, and there's the anticipation that because I can't guarantee in my own head with complete, you know, with complete confidence that I'm going to be successful in the future, so why bother trying at all? Says Reb Biederman, you know what you have to focus on? Today. Today. Don't worry about whether you learned yesterday. Don't even focus on whether you're going to have time to learn tomorrow. You know what you focus on? You focus today. And if you learn a little bit, that's a victory. And if you made minyan today, that's a victory. And if you exercise today, that's a victory. And if you didn't eat that chocolate cake, that's a victory. If you didn't eat the cholent, that's a victory. Don't worry that you're going to eat the cholent tomorrow or the chocolate cake tomorrow or you're going to look at the thing. Focus on today and each day being a victory in and of itself. He quotes the Yismach Yisrael, who says, the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Tfechot Natati Yamai, which means that like Hashem says, I gave you your years, like a tfechot is like a rope, almost, I think. Like a tefach, like it's a hand's breadth. Thank you. So he writes here, quoting the Yismach Yisrael, Shekeshem shechaval aruch, afilum shivim ama, nimdad bitfachayim. A rope, even if it's, I'll use a rope, but even if it's 70 amos long, what is it really made of? It's made of one string, and another string, and another string. He says, kach gam kol shnos chayi adam. That's how we have to view our life. Nimdadim lifnei yamim, that we are measured by our days. And if we can conquer every day, and if every day we could say, I was a little bit better than yesterday, that's going to be successful. Shekol yom chashavu bifnei atzmo, that every day is important in and of itself. Ve'ino talo klaba yamim shahayu lefanov v'kadmulo. And today is important regardless of what happened yesterday and regardless of what's going to happen tomorrow. And that's why he says, according to the Beis Aharon, that's why it's vayivarcheim bayom hahu. Yaakov Avinu is giving the bracha that we should merit to be able to focus on today. That we shouldn't let the past hold us back, and we shouldn't let the future hold us back as well. He quotes here a very beautiful idea. So what happens? Yosef brings Ephraim and Menashe. Help me out here, because I get confused every time. Yosef puts them, because you and I are directionally the opposite, so we're going to get a little confused here, right? So Yosef brings Ephraim and Menashe. I'll be Yaakov. So who does he put on the right? Who does he put on the left? He puts Menashe on the right, and Ephraim on the... Is that right? Ephraim on... No, am I wrong? Vayikach Yosef Eshneim. On Yaakov's right.
Yaakov's left.
So Ephraim's here. I told you this would get confusing, because it would be easier if I stood like this. But that would also be disrespectful to you. Okay? So Yosef puts him in one direction. And what does then Yaakov do? Of course, we know he famously swaps his hand. So asks the Divrei Yecheskel on the next page, page number 3. What's his whole bid? With he puts him on one side and then he swaps his hand. What's going on here? He says, this is the idea. That if you go to the third underline here. Second underline. Dine Yosef Savar. Yosef felt, what's the most important? The most important, Demisha Bola Sos Tshuva, that someone who wants to do tshuva, what do you first have to do? He says, you first have to do tshuva about the past. That's what Yosef thought. Aval Yaakov Avinu Savar, but Yaakov Avinu comes and says, no. Don't worry about your past. Worry about now and going forward. Laharbos mitzvos umaisim tovim. And just do good, do mitzvos, do maisim tovim. And don't worry about your past. And therefore he says, after that underline, Al kein hemid Yosef es Ephraim b'smol aviv, ves Menashe b'yamin aviv. Why does he put Menashe to the right? Because he thought that Menashe was the key. What does Menashe come from the Hebrew word of? Kinashani Elokim. From the language of forgetful. In other words, he says, "V'savar shemidas minasha ikar latakin mikodem ma shechit v'lishkoach mimasim arayim." He thinks the first thing you got to do is to first forget and fix everything you did previously. In other words, all the forgotten things you did previously, you got to fix that. What does Yaakov mean to do? Yaakov takes his right hand, moves it from Menashe to Ephraim. Because what does Ephraim represent? Ki hifrani Elokim. Hifrani means that Hashem caused me to be fruitful. Not just fruitful in terms of having children, but fruitful in terms of building. Fruitful in terms of being constructive. And therefore, says Reb Biederman, Aval Yaakov shakal es yadav kedei levarech es madregas Ephraim bimino. He wanted Ephraim to be on the right. Because kihu ikar, because that's the essence. Shim rotze lasos tshuva yarbe betoro mitzvos mehayom v'hala v'lo yamtin achi etakin mashachit. And so what's really happening, he says here, is a debate. When you want to do tshuva, do you spend the time clapping al chetz about the past and worrying about the past and obsessing about the past? That's what Yosef thinks is the most important thing. Yaakov comes, no. He switches it to Ephraim. Ki frani Elokim. That the most important thing is to be productive. Don't worry about the, you know what you got to do today? Come to Minyan today. Don't focus that you haven't come today. You missed your diet the last, 3 months. Don't focus on that. You're going to beat yourself up. You're going to ruin your self-esteem. You're going to feel bad about it. No one's ever succeeded in life by feeling bad about themselves. And so Yaakov switches his hand from Menashe to Ephraim, saying that the best way to change is by being productive going forward. Whatever you want to start, start it now. And that's what he says is the Bayom Hahu. That's what Yaakov gives the bracha, Vayivarchim Bayom Hahu Leimor. To not obsess about the past and to not even be anxious about whether you'll succeed in the future, but to focus on doing good right now. Start today. Don't delay. Don't let the past hold you back. Don't let the future hold you back, but live in the present each and every day. And if every day is better than the day before, then you and I will have succeeded throughout our life, as he quoted from Tehillim, that our life is really a composition of all of our days, a compilation of all of our days together. So idea number one was the idea of Acharisa Yamim, that remembering that there's always another chapter to be written. In our lives as individuals, there's always an Acharisa Yamim. And in our lives as a nation, there's always an Acharisa Yamim. What an empowering idea. By the way, we represent that all the time. We finish a Masechta, what do? Hadron Alach. The first words that come out of our mouth. We're going to come back to you. Right? There's going to be more learning. We start the next Masechta. We have Simchas Torah. What do? We start the Torah again. Right? Why is Tchias HaMesim, Mashiach, so fundamental to Judaism? Because we always believe that there's that next chapter to be written. There's no ending. Idea number two is this beautiful idea from Reb Biederman. Why is it the Bayom Hahu, a reminder to us to appreciate and to live in every moment, to not obsess about the past, to not be anxious about the future, but to maximize the moment that we have in front of you, the Bayom Hahu. Idea number three, you'll notice, is a very long idea. I copied the whole thing for you. And that is because, Baruch Hashem, I'm pretty sure everyone in this room can read English. And I don't know that I'll do justice to it in the short time that I have, but I want you to have it because I loved the idea. And I think there's so many things you could do about it. Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, in 1964, December 19, 1964, gave the following drasha. And I'm going to summarize it for you, but I'll do the best that I can. Essentially what he says is, and I'll say it outside and then I'll say it inside, is that memories, he says, can have opposite emotional effects, can have two opposite emotional effects. Either memories can reignite what we'll call trauma or rage or baggage, or memories can help you appreciate how far you've come to enhance your sense of empathy and to reinforce gratitude. So your memories of the past can do one of two things. Either it can conjure up all of those negative emotions and make you feel bitter and angry and more traumatic, or it can remind you how far you've come and therefore appreciate where you are and to be more empathetic to people who've gone through that situation. How does Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb get there? So he quotes here on the bottom of that page where I have the arrow. He says here the following. He quotes the Medrash, which talks about that when Yaakov Avinu is being buried in Canaan, so Yosef and all the brothers go up to Canaan with Yaakov, they bury him, and then they come back. And the Medrash says, if you go to the next page, that on their way back, they passed by the exact same pit that the brothers threw Yosef into. And when they got to that pit, Yosef pauses, and he looks into the pit. And you could almost imagine, you have to imagine the scene. Yosef is standing over the pit with the snakes and the scorpions, and the brothers are standing behind him. And the Medrash describes how the brothers are overwhelmed with fear. Now, you understand why they're overwhelmed with fear, because Yosef is reliving the traumatic experience that they had. And how do they think Yosef's going to respond? Probably like you and I would respond. He's going to see the trigger. He's going to remember that the brothers threw him in and sold him to slavery. And he's going to, now he's in a position of power. What's he going to do? He's going to lash out to them. Now, we, of course, know that's not what happens. But listen to what Rabbi Dr. Lamb does with this imagery of Yosef revisiting the pit. He says the following. And this is on, it says page 2 on the top of the drasha. No, let's actually go to page 3. And again, you can read this on your own. It's beautiful. Top of page number 3 there. He says, "This then is what the pit revisited did for Yosef. It kept him human, restrained his ego, controlled his self-importance. The pit reinforced his sympathy for the poor and the wretched, the anguished and the humiliated everywhere. That long, lingering look into the dark pit from which he began his torturous climb up the ladder of success kept him from getting a dizzy head now that he stood at the very top." In other words, instead of it having a negative impact on Yosef, what it did is it helped him remember where he came from and how far he's come, and therefore to appreciate those who were in his position previously. He says, "Is it not something that all of us would benefit from?" Go to the next one. He says, "I once visited another city, the home of a very wealthy industrialist. It was a house which was lavishly appointed. On the walls of his parlor, there were hung famous paintings, original masterpieces. Amongst them, I noticed something quite unusual. Surrounded by a very expensive frame was what looked like a discolored frayed piece of cloth. At first, I hesitated to inquire about it, fearing that I would thereby display my ignorance of avant-garde art. But after a while, I asked what this was. He said, quote, 'It is nothing but an ordinary rag. I had it framed so that I might look at it and remember that no matter how much I have now, I must always keep in mind that I began as a poor, hungry, barefoot lad with few pennies whose few pennies were earned by being a menial rag picker. It helps me keep my sense of balance and proportion. It is a reminder that I don't own the world. It does not let me forget what it is like to be hungry." And so this person kept that rag on his bookshelf as a reminder of where he once was, how far he's come. It keeps him humble, but it also makes him have more empathy and sensitivity to those who are in the position that he used to be. Says Rabbi Dr. Lamb, "Pity our affluent society." I think this is amazing because he wrote this a long time ago. He says, "Pity our affluent society." 60 years ago. Thank you.
In a month.
"I sometimes am sorry for our children who have no pit to return to as Yosef did." This spoke to me. It resonated with me. I'm very conscious of the fact that, I'll speak for myself, that I raised my children in a privileged lifestyle. It really is. We live in Boca Raton. All of us have challenges, but by and large, from a Jewish perspective, from a community perspective, our children live privileged lives, by and large. He says, "Our children, bless you, have no pit to return to, as did Yosef. How shall they ever learn to attain a true perspective on life? In the deeper sense, the children of our society of plenty are underprivileged, spiritually deprived. They have never known hunger or fear or poverty in the past, a lack of toys or gadgets in the present, or the inability to expect an abundance of cars and cruises and trips before they are ready for it in the near future. Most parents, at least, remember their own humble beginnings." Right? This is the old, like, when my day I climbed up, the hill in the snow, backwards and forwards to get to school. This is the equivalent of it. "Some were refugees and know what it was like to leave everything you have and go into flight for your life. But how can our children know the bitter cup of life can be, how uncertain life is, and therefore to appreciate what they have and to use their affluence properly without sacrificing character in the process? American Jews are today assimilating at an unprecedented rate. I believe that one of the reasons is their false sense of security, for they know of the dreadful experience of our people in Europe only in an abstract and theoretical sense. That is why I would urge parents and schools to teach their children, when they are ready for it, the complete story of what our pit looks like." In other words, what's the pit? Yosef had his pit that he went back to. We have a pit also. We have pits in Poland and throughout Europe. We have pits in Israel. Knows there are pits that we can return to help our children understand the sacrifices that were made for them to appreciate their life. But he argues how important and critical it is to be able to do that, because that's what teaches children gratitude. They can only appreciate what they have in the backdrop of the sacrifices that people made to get them here. They can only be sensitive to people who have less than them if they understand that their parents, grandparents, great-grandparents also had nothing, and that they came from nothing, and to help them empathize and sympathize with people. So he writes that that's the da me'ayin bata, to know where you came from, to go back to that pit as Yosef did, and to stare over it, and to appreciate just how far he came. But now you understand why the brothers were afraid. Because what did the brothers assume Yosef would do? They assumed he would have the opposite reaction. They assumed that Yosef would come to that pit, he would look at his past and he would be filled with rage. That he would look at the past and find it continuing to be traumatic. And by the way, we know there have been books written about this, the seventh million, I think there was a book written, right, of people who the trauma continues to flow, and we don't judge, obviously we understand, but who continue to penetrate their DNA. He says, but what does Yosef do? So you have this like dynamic. Yosef's looking in the pit. The brothers are afraid that him looking in the pit is going to lead to rage and anger and trauma. Yosef, though, what does he do at that moment? So the Gemara says here, the Medrash, that at that moment, Yosef made a bracha. Uberchu alav kamo shechayv adam levarich ala makom shenasa lo neis. Baruch hamakom shasa neis b'makom hazeh. Instead of using it to make him bitter and angry, what does Yosef do? He makes a bracha there. In other words, he uses it constructively. He uses it to build him into who he is. He uses it for appreciation. He uses it for empathy. He uses it not for trauma and for anger, but to appreciate how far he has come. And that's how Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb understands this imagery, this really beautiful imagery of Yosef standing over the pit. And I think for every one of us, and I think this is the point that Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb, certainly as a people, we've had lots of pits throughout our history, pits that we can and should return to. I think that's one of the, actually the beauties of Tisha B'Av and what differentiates Judaism from other religions. Tisha B'Av is the day where we stare the pit right in the abyss, into the abyss, and we understand and appreciate how much we've been through as a people and the sacrifices that have been made. And therefore, what does it lead to? We don't hold it there, but it leads us into the happiest day of the year, Tu B'Av. In other words, we take that past, but we use it to appreciate the present and to build. And I think in any one of our lives, and again, you can make the connection to something in your life, but I think everyone has that pit. Everyone has that part of their past, that memory that can go in one of two opposite different emotional ways. Either it can reignite and reinforce that sense of rage or anger or trauma, or it can enhance an appreciation for how far you've come, to enhance an empathy for people who are going through similar things, and to reinforce a sense of gratitude that while you were once in the pit, you are no longer in that pit. So we saw three ideas. Idea number one was the idea of acharis hayamim, that in Judaism there's always an acher. There's never an ending to the story, whether it's in the Tanakh, whether it's in Jewish history, in our own lives, to always believe that there's an acharei, that there's something that comes next, that beautiful idea from Rabbi Sachs. Next we saw for Biederman, why does the pasuk say vayivarchim bayom hahu? Why does it have to say on that day? Because it's a reminder to us to not let our past hold us back, not to let the anxiety over the future prevent us from trying, but to live in every day and to make the most of every day. That's the Bayom Ahu. And the last is Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. Why does Yosef go back to the pit? And that beautiful imagery of him standing over the pit and the different reactions between him and his brothers. Yosef saw it and he made a bracha because he channeled it for positivity. He recognized how far he'd come and it led him to appreciation and to empathy. The brothers, on the other hand, saw that same pit, and how did they think Yosef was going to respond? With rage and anger. And that's the moral lesson that Yosef teaches us in that moment. I wish everyone a good Shabbat.